At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Trying once again to make sense of consumers and the American economy. Facebook has some privacy issues, and it's prom season, you know. Do you know where your tuxedo is? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Friday today, the 13th of May. Good to have you with us. There are something like 42 bajillion variables that go into figuring out how the American economy is doing. It's just that complicated an organism. But one of the biggies is a little number called CPI, the Consumer Price Index, or inflation. The Labor Department said today it's up 3.2% over a year ago. And if you listen to this radio program at all lately, you know most of that is in food and energy costs. But even what the government calls core CPI, all the other stuff, basically, is up as well to its highest level in more than a year. Now, I mention that for two reasons. A, inflation is still historically really low. But B, we talked just yesterday about how the rising cost of gas is pulling spending away from other parts of the economy. How then to reconcile that at a lot of department store chains, sales and profits have come roaring back? Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman explains.
Business is great at Macy's, Nordstrom, and other fancy department stores, but most consumers are still strapped for cash. It's a disconnect because well-heeled shoppers are disconnected from economic trouble, says analyst Richard Jaffe at Stifel Nicolaus.
Consumer at Nordstrom and some of these better department stores is certainly in the top half of the U.S. economy and fairly immune to variations in gas or food prices.
Jaffe says the so-called aspirational consumer is back, willing to pay full retail, or nearly that, for brands that represent luxury and status. And he says chains like Nordstrom have invested to meet them with a clicks-and-mortar strategy.
So the consumer can find a shoe that fits and order it in three colors and have it delivered to their home. And similarly, they can shop online and then go to the store to pick it up.
I met Tim O'Hearn coming out of the Nordstrom in downtown Portland this morning. I asked what he'd been shopping for.
Socks.
Why do you pick Nordstrom?
I mean, there's cheaper socks elsewhere, right? I like good quality things. I like to shop in an environment that is attractive.
And wouldn't you know, O'Hearn is also a small retailer with a pair of luxury linen shops in Portland and San Francisco.
We do not have to sell at discounted prices as much as we used to. Customers, if it's the right product, are buying it at a fair retail price.
Following in the footsteps of Big Brother Nordstrom, sales at O'Hearn's stores were great in April. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
You'd suppose Facebook, of all companies, would know there is no such thing as privacy on the internet. I mean, right? So what could the social networking site possibly have been thinking when it hired Burson Marsteller, a big-name Washington PR firm, to plant nasty stories in the press about Google and its privacy policies? Marketplace's Steve Henn has that story.
Any good DC political operative knows there are a thousand ways Facebook could have tried to smear Google without leaving fingerprints. There are PR firms in the Capitol that do little else than practice what they affectionately call the dark arts. But this time, Facebook and Burson Marsteller failed.
You know, it seems to be a case of inexperience.
Peter Stone's a reporter at the Center for Public Integrity who covers money in politics.
I think a skilled company probably would have gone to a nonprofit, channeled the money to a front group, if you want to call it that, that doesn't have to disclose its donors.
Then the front group can smear away and Facebook's hands are clean. Now, Stone's not endorsing this kind of behavior. He's just saying it's gotten pretty common. I called a handful of folks who practice the dark arts, and none would talk on tape because they were either hoping to land Facebook as a client or already working for a competitor. All that makes Mary Spaeth furious.
It sends the message that this is how public relations and communication strategists behave, and that's just not true.
Spaeth runs her own crisis communications firm in Dallas. She says in this case, Facebook probably ended up paying a small fortune for some terrible advice.
I think it's never a good idea to try and hide. First of all, it always comes out.
And when it does, it ends up hurting you more than the company you were criticizing. In Silicon Valley, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
So what do you think of Ashton Kutcher, by the way? I ask because you're about to be seeing a whole lot more of him. CBS announced today that Kutcher's going to take over for Charlie Sheen in that hit comedy Two and a Half Men. The deal comes just before what is arguably the biggest week on television's calendar, the upfronts, when the networks reveal what's going to be on in the fall and advertisers start buying ads. But with ever more cable channels and internet options and video games out there, not to mention the fact that a lot of us are just sailing right by TV ads with a click of the TiVo button, it does seem a little strange that advertisers are paying more than ever. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith has a look at what gives.
Advertisers are expected to shell out a record $9.5 billion on network TV ads this year. Not that they'll be playing to record audiences. Tim Malloy is TV editor at TheWrap.com.
Networks are getting extremely good at doing everything they possibly can to make sure advertisers get their dollar worth.
Like allowing more product placement in shows. Those DVR-proof sales pitches are not only getting screen time, they're starting to get script time, too. Take this scene from 30 Rock.
These Verizon wireless phones are just so popular, I accidentally grabbed one belonging to an acquaintance.
If I saw a phone like that on TV, I would be like, where is my nearest retailer so I can get one? Can we have our money now?
Networks are also exploring interactive ads, like coupons or games that are tied to a traditional ad spot. Michael Finn is president of Brightline, a company that creates those ads.
Networks are really trying to figure out a way to charge more for commercials by having more engagement taking place on the screen.
And, all innovation aside, TV is still the best way to reach the biggest audience, says media analyst Tom Adams with IHS Screen Digest.
Despite now 15-plus years of the internet and proliferating channels and DVRs and everything else that's going on, the main activity continues to be sitting down at 8 o'clock after dinner and seeing what's on TV.
So technologies may come and go, but our couch potato hood, you can take that to the bank. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, yeah, no. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Every time you think you can get past news of the financial crisis, reality has a way of sneaking up on you. It happens here with stories about housing and Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And it's been happening over in Europe a lot, with all the talk over there that Greece might need another bailout from the European Union lest it default on its debts. So that's what we're going to talk about in our weekly wrap of Wall Street and Beyond. Cardiff Garcia is here from the blog FT Alphaville, along with our very own New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore. Good to talk to you both again.
Good to talk to you, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
All right, so the first question, Cardiff, is short and sweet, goes to you. Is Greece going to default or not?
And the answer is short and sweet in response. I don't know, but I'm pretty sure
But I would lean towards yes if by default you mean a sort of basic restructuring. Look, right now politicians in Europe are either in denial or more likely they just haven't figured out how to agree on who's going to share the pain. It's going to be some combination of the countries that backed the official bailout loans, bondholders in Greek debt, probably a lot of European banks, and Greece itself through more austerity measures, higher taxes, and things like that. But it's an incredibly complex question politically, and it's really tough to say how exactly they're going to arrive at some kind of an agreement.
Which is where Heidi Moore comes in. How are they going to fix this, seeing that they already bailed them out once?
Well, if they don't bail them out again, what is the option, right? It's the same exact issue that they faced the last time, which is you can't have a country in the Eurozone fail and have the rest of the Eurozone succeed. It just can't happen. So either Greece will have to leave the Eurozone, which was rumored incorrectly last week, or they're just going to have to sit down and restructure like big boys.
Okay, wait. Why incorrect? I mean, the rumor was incorrect, but why is it bad if Greece decides to bail out of the Eurozone, Cardiff?
Well, for a number of reasons. Number one, there's no precedent for it, and we just don't know exactly how markets would react. For Greece, it would be a disaster in the short term because it wouldn't have access to any kind of public market financing. And so it's unclear exactly how the entire government would function. For the rest of the Eurozone, you might have suspicions that other countries are going to follow suit. Bondholders, once again, would lose faith in some of the countries that they're especially worried about. I think Spain would be the biggest one. And really, it would be chaos. So I think it'd be bad for everybody. That doesn't mean it's not going to happen at some point. But right now, I think it's still one of the less likely scenarios.
Right. Yeah. And another thing that is bad is that, you know, Germany lent Greece money in good euros, and they don't want to get paid back in worthless drachmas. So you want to keep – everyone wants to get paid back in the money that they gave.
Keep going with that theme, Heidi, of the broader implications for Europe, right? Because we're still churning over this European debt thing, what, like 2 years later?
Right, exactly. I mean, none of these problems are very easy to solve. They're systemic. They are about the way that we do business in Europe and in America. And we keep digging and digging and digging. And we can only hope that the digging actually gets us to the source. If not, we're just creating a bigger hole. But we'll see.
Yeah, man, that is a perfect segue, by the way, to a very quick discussion of Raj Rajaratnam, the way Wall Street does business, and my fear, I would say, Cardiff, that this story is going to go gently into that good night, and in a week and a half, none of us are going to remember his name, and it's going to be business as usual.
It might. There are still some cases tied to this particular case that might be pursued. I think the more interesting question is whether or not this is actually going to deter future insider trading, right? So it might, but on the other hand, insider traders might just get smarter about it, though at least in that case, it's still more expensive. I think the really big unanswered question, though, is whether or not this kind of case, given the premise that you just inserted into the conversation, makes sense to justify the kind of government resources that they've thrown at it. That's a complicated question, too, and one that I also don't know the answer
well,
to.
Well, Heidi, it seems to me it does kind of make sense, right, if you want to install or reinstall confidence in Wall Street.
Yes, it absolutely does. And in fact, the government has a number of cases lined up throughout the spring and summer to test this again. And in fact, on Monday, more of Raj's accomplices are going to be tried. So don't lose faith, Kai.
All right, I won't. I'll try to keep it. And I'll keep it with you guys, too. Heidi Moore from our New York Bureau, Cardiff Garcia from the blog FT Alphaville. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you, Kai.
Thanks, Kai. Have a good weekend.
I grant you that this is kind of a generalization, but most of us try to eat healthy when we can. And those of us who are parents want our kids to do the same. Commentator Mark Bittman says it'd sure be great if the government played along.
Let's play pretend, shall we? Pretend your child's teacher is distributing snacks twice a day, morning and afternoon. Snickers, Pop-Tarts, Mountain Dew, some fries, maybe a few nachos. Pretend you complain to the principal. The principal says to the teacher, could you please stop doing that? You have until, let's say, 5 years from Tuesday. Crazy, right? Yet that's pretty much what the Federal Trade Commission did recently with its food marketing guidelines. The agency would like big food to market healthier food to kids and refrain from marketing junk food altogether. but they're asking, not telling. The guidelines won't take effect for 5 years, and when they do, they're voluntary. Tell me, what good are voluntary guidelines 5 years from now? 5 years from now, your 5-year-old is 10, and your newborn is 5. Their eating patterns are set. 5 more years, at least, of America bulking up? Who'll pay for all that diabetes? Requesting voluntary compliance from a blame-the-victim industry that pushes ultra-processed junk is like requesting that a cigarette smoker quit in 5 years. Junk food is the poster child for what's wrong with American food and, in turn, our diet. Obesity comes from excess calories and causes diabetes, and excess calories come from junk food. No one in industry is interested in regulation. They may gripe about the voluntary guidelines, but I'll bet there's a collective sigh of relief at what appears to be a brokered deal that gives the industry a 5-year break-in period before... Before what? Before nothing. In the meantime, keep feeding the kids those Snickers.
Mark Bittman is a columnist for the New York Times. He's also the author of the book, How to Cook Everything. Send us your comments, whether you can cook or not. Write to us at marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Forget prom dresses. Retailers will say anything to get a guy into a tux.
Did you see the movie Hangover? Did you see what all the guys wore? Don't you want to look like them? Here we can make it possible.
That's coming up, but first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials gave back 100 points today, 0.8%, closed at 12,595. The NASDAQ forfeited 34 points, about 1.2%, ended things at a neatly symmetrical 28.28. The S&P 500 shed 10 points, about 0.8%, finished at 13.37. For the week gone by, the Dow slipped 0.3%. The S&P reversed 0.2%. The NASDAQ was, well, we'll call it a win there. It was flat. Worries about the European debt crisis rattled financial firms, just like Heidi and Cardiff and I were talking about. Bank of America withdrew nearly 2.25% today. J.P. Morgan Chase unloaded 0.2%. Citigroup declined 2%. Goldman Sachs lost close to 1% on this Friday. Tech shares got slammed. Yahoo fell more than 3.5% today over troubles with the Chinese online payment business Alipay. Yahoo owns a chunk of that company. Intel chipped off 1.25%. Google lost about 1% or so. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com. Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune in to Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up on Monday. Rahm Emanuel takes the oath as the 46th mayor of Chicago. The National Association of Home Builders releases its housing market index for May. And child actress turned international pop star Janet Jackson turns 45. I'm Avishai, Mr. Artsy, if you're nasty.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Human rights organizers in Syria say at least 6 people have been killed in protests there today. This is the 8th straight week of unrest in one of the Middle East's most tightly controlled societies. Anthony Shadid is covering Syria for the New York Times. He's in Beirut, Lebanon. Good to have you with us.
My pleasure.
First of all, today's protests, what do we know about them? It certainly seems like they haven't calmed down in the face of government crackdowns.
I think that's exactly right. There was a real test today on the part of the protesters about whether they could turn out the numbers again in the streets. Now, at least anecdotally, the protests did seem smaller. And in some cities like Beni Yass on the Mediterranean coast and Deraa in southern Syria, the towns were relatively quiet. No protests happened there. And, of course, those towns are the scenes of the biggest crackdown. But tellingly, in a city like Homs, Syria's third largest city, you did see protests. And this is a city we have to remember that was assaulted by the Syrian military this past week. So it was a mixed message in a way. The government proved it can subdue some towns, at least by brute force. On the other hand, protesters proved that they're resilient, that they can still turn out numbers in places that have been basically besieged.
Who's out there on the streets? Is it working class folks, or is it the elites and doctors, or some combination?
Well, I think that's a good question, and it illustrates a lot about this uprising. You haven't seen the business elite in places like Damascus and Aleppo, Syria's two largest cities, come out in the streets. You really haven't seen the educated middle class. So what we're looking at, I think, in some ways is an uprising of the dispossessed, and that may be overstating it, but it reflects a countryside that's been neglected by the government for the sake of the big cities, Damascus and Aleppo, for years. And it's also a reflection of a state that really hasn't been able to meet the demands of its people, basic services, a social contract, if you will, that was in place for the past 40 years.
Bashar al-Assad launched a bunch of economic reforms 5-6 years ago. I imagine those are all out the window now.
Well, it's not necessarily that it's out the window, but I think in some ways these protests reflect the impact of those economic reforms. This was a country that had a very large public sector. The reforms that President Assad introduced dismantled that public sector in some degrees, and critics have called it a transition from crony socialism to crony capitalism. What you've seen is a small elite prosper, and you've seen the poor get poorer, especially in the countryside. And that very much is an essence of this uprising, that disenchantment from these economic reforms that President Bashar al-Assad has put in place. His vision was always one of economic modernization before political modernization. In other words, we were going to have economic reforms that would bring the China kind of model to Syria, and that might offset the demands for political change. That hasn't been the case, obviously, given the protests going on right now.
You know, you read a lot of reports saying that Syria is a linchpin of the Middle East. It's a key factor in stability there. Why? What's the economic relationship, and what's the regional issue?
Well, and I think you pointed out well, there's an economic relationship here and there's a political relationship. I mean, Syria, particularly under the rule of the Assad family for the past 40 years, has always played a key regional role, and it's often relied on that leverage it plays in the region to try to balance its enemies and its allies. The economic side of that relationship is one that's emerging, but one that's no less interesting. Syria and Turkey almost went to war more than a decade ago. Today, there, at least until this protest began, there was a growing friendship there. Prime Minister Erdogan in Turkey has repeatedly warned the Syrian government not to be excessive in its use of force. Syrian officials themselves feel betrayed by this. So I think we're seeing a shift in that relationship, and it could very much have implications on what a lot of people in the region had seen as a new vision for integration, for prosperity, for trade, for bilateral ties. So I think it's a very decisive moment in some ways.
Anthony Shadid from the New York Times, covering the protests in Syria from Beirut, Lebanon, which is pretty much the only way to do it these days. Anthony, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
We're about at that time of year where we start to see high schoolers around town wearing fancy dresses and just slightly ill-fitting tuxedos. Yes, indeed, it is prom season, and most of the attention goes to the dresses, but a lot of the money goes to the tuxes. Once you get past the smaller formal wear shops, the tux rental business pretty much belongs to Men's Warehouse. At least it has till now. Marketplace's Jennifer Collins reports.
Joseph A. Bank has been selling menswear for over a century. It has hundreds of stores. The name of the place still trips people up.
Every day you'll get somebody that comes in, hey, let's go to Jose Banks or Jose Banks.
Charles Talbert is the manager of a Joseph A. Bank in a suburb of Los Angeles. The chain isn't exactly known as a mecca of hip fashion.
You know, we're extremely familiar to people as far as suits. in this respect, we want to kind of introduce ourselves to the young upstarts.
To do that, Joseph A. Bank is adding tuxedo rentals. This is its first prom season. Stifel Nicolaus retail analyst Richard Jaffe says tux rentals may be one of the cheapest and easiest ways to get young shoppers into a chain known for suits and suspenders.
The math is easy.
Chains pay about $150 for the tux. They rent it out for about $150, typically more than 10 times.
You're talking about a tremendous profit margin.
Tux rentals bring in about $1 billion in the U.S. every year, and Men's Warehouse has cornered about a third of that market. Maybe you're familiar with its slogan.
Warehouse, you're going to like the way you look. I guarantee it.
I wanted to check out that guarantee, but first I had to get past Men's Warehouse assistant manager Mary Marshall. She was pretty suspicious of my microphone.
I just don't want it to be from somewhere like Joseph A. Bank's spot. Yeah. They're not doing very well in tuxedo.
Marshall, on the other hand, has been busy.
32 ways.
My fat.
Trim high school senior Riley Donaldson is being fitted for a tux he'll wear to his girlfriend Lisa Vitale's prom. She's here, and so is her dress.
So it's just white and long, and then it has like rhinestone-y strap that's like one strap.
It's bedazzled.
Now Donaldson needs a bedazzled tux to go with it.
If I wasn't here, which one would you pick?
I'd call my mom. And I'd be like, Mom, you got a situation. This one, because no one else is going to have that.
Okay. He picks a silver vest. Analyst Richard Jaffe says the store doesn't want the transaction to end there.
So they're trying to walk him over to the other department and say, gee, did you see the movie Hangover? Did you see what all the guys wore? Don't you want to look like them? Here we can make it possible.
Jaffe says Men's Warehouse and Joseph A. Bank may be going after each other, but it's the independent formal wear shops that really need to worry.
It'd be much easier and much more likely that they would take market share from the regional players and the mom and pops.
After all, the store did have pretty much everything Donaldson asked about.
Should I wear an ascot?
If you want.
Come on, no one's going to have an ascot or a cane.
Okay, he didn't go with a cane, but he did go with a silver bow tie. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, two of them, actually. First of all, a correction to my comment Wednesday that Newt Gingrich appropriated his campaign phrase, "Win the Future," from the White House. Totally not true, as it turns out, thanks to the several alert listeners who reminded me that the former Speaker of the House wrote a book way back in 2005 called Winning the Future. Also, this from the annals of governments trying to whittle down their deficits. Reuters reports today that the British government is going to save taxpayers almost $800,000 by selling off some of the fine wines it has in its cellars and replacing it with cheaper stuff to serve to visiting dignitaries. In other news, who knew governments had wine cellars anyway? Not me. All right, that's it. We're out of here. That's Marketplace from APM American Public Media. Today, the Dow lost 100 points, 0.8%. The NASDAQ gave up 34 points, 1.2%. The S&P 500 dropped 10 points, about 0.8%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson, the executive producer of the program. This guy by the name of J.J. Yore. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, low rates, low prices, good time to buy a house. Still stressful, though.
A lot of tears, a lot of craziness. Oh, no, it was so horrifying. It got to the point where I was like, I don't want the house. You know, I was at a breaking point.
Yeah, been there. I'm Kai Rizdal. Have yourself a great weekend. We will see you back here on Monday. This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.